Welcome to the Grant Writing Simplified podcast. This is the place to learn how to make a big impact in your community through grant writing and nonprofit consulting. The world needs you to step forward as a grant writer and use your skills to lead with confidence. I'm Teresa Huff, former special ed teacher turned grant writer and nonprofit strategist. In my 20 years of freelancing, I've helped nonprofits triple their funding and exponentially increase their reach. Now I'm stepping up to mentor freelancers and nonprofit leaders like you who are ready to take your skills to the next level. It's time to get intentional about your vision so you can create lasting change in your community. Learn the skills and strategies you need to become the grant writer the world needs. Let's do this. Hey friends, welcome back. Hope you are having a great week. I am having a lot of fun prepping for some grant writing workshops that I'm leading the next couple months, which is something I don't know if I've really talked about a lot on the show before, but I wanted to make sure that you're aware that I love doing workshops in person and on Zoom. So if that's something that your organization, your local community foundation, somebody like that wants to bring in and do an in-person workshop, let me know and we'll talk about that. I am totally down for that. It's so much fun getting to work with nonprofits in person, really helping them think through their strategy, do some hands-on activities. We have lots of fun. So let me know. Reach out on my website and we can talk more about that. Today's guest is a bit of a unique twist from anyone I've ever had on the show before. And I first heard this guest on another podcast and I was like, ooh, I need to see if he'll come on. And fortunately, he was like, yeah, absolutely. So I'm talking today with Chris Ekimoff, and he is a forensic accountant, which sounds so intriguing and interesting. And it really is. The work he does is so important. And now don't be scared off by that. It's not something scary. He actually is here to help nonprofits with a lot of prevention. And normally I don't read a guest bio word for word, but his is so intriguing that I'm going to read it to you anyway, because it's just so interesting what he does. When the numbers don't add up or financial litigation is on the horizon, Chris brings the insight his clients need to balance the books. Chris has provided litigation consulting and forensic accounting services, including as an expert witness in internal investigations regarding financial reporting questions, allegations of accounting and auditing malpractice, and other complex financial and accounting issues. As a CPA and CCF, or a certified fraud examiner, Chris has experience in investigating both the fraud in the financials and the people who are alleged to have committed it. So it's so intriguing. And as Chris really emphasizes, and I try to really stress this too in the episode, this is not a scare tactic. We are not trying to do anything that would make you feel super unsettled or, oh no, now we have to start scrutinizing everything about our organization. Oh no, who's doing fraud? Who's trying to cheat us out of things? Like, this is not to send you out on a hunt to find who's doing something wrong. This is to create awareness. This is to help you be proactive, to create good systems, good preventions, good checks and balances, to help you understand the wisdom of that. And if maybe you have a team or board that doesn't quite understand the importance of this, this interview will be a really good tool and a great resource for you to share with them to really underline the importance of setting up good checks and balances and having these things in place that Chris talks about for some of the interesting reasons that he's going to share with us today. So I hope you enjoy this unique and fun episode. Here we go. Chris, welcome to the show. It's great to meet you face to face here on online. So tell us before we begin, tell us a random fact about yourself.
Oh, a random fact about me. Well, I spent a lot of my childhood, high school, and college as a competitive swimmer. And at one point actually got dragged, and I mean that, you know, honestly, dragged to a nationals meet by a relay team that was very good. A lot of these guys went on to swim, you know, in Olympic trials and beyond. I was definitely not of that set, but they needed a fourth. And an interesting fact about making that nationals meet is I warmed up in the same lane as a guy named Michael Phelps, who obviously has gone on to be very good at swimming.
Maybe heard of him.
That's right. Early days for him. And again, I was just a guy in his way while he was warming up to win a bunch of medals. And like I said, I was the alternate on a relay for that. So definitely a past life for me, but something that always, you know, brings me a little bit of joy to think that, you know, I was this close. Maybe not this close, but I was right there with some of the best. Sure,
yeah.
You got it.
And I'm sure you just about edged him out in the final relay.
He's just lucky that we weren't in the same events. I mean, that was really, I think he was dodging me. For that.
He would have been a goner. That would have been you on the Olympic podium.
Absolutely not. Definitely not true.
That's fun, though. So tell us a little bit about what you do, because this is a really unique niche that I haven't had a guest on the show before. And when I heard you actually on another podcast, I was like, ooh, I think we should chat. So tell us a little bit about what you do and why.
My job, I'm a CPA, background in debits and credits, have always been interested in accounting, very orderly, very structured, very organized. But my practice and the career that I've kind of leaned into over the past 15 years or so is what we call forensic accounting. And I don't know if your producer wants to insert some scary music here. And forensic accounting is really a discipline under a broader set of consulting services of accountants, where it's not an audit, it's not tax services, but it is a focus on specific issues that a business, an individual, an organization may have a higher interest in. And I try to be general like that because everybody thinks about Bernie Madoff. Everybody thinks about tax fraud. And that's really not the focus of forensic accounting generally. All of those things kind of fall under that mantle. But what forensic accountants really look to do is answer a question that's been asked. Hey, you know, I'm running a manufacturing business, and every year we project out what we think our inventory cost is going to be. And every year we're off by 10%. Chris, can you come in and help us understand why? No one has stolen anything, right? The police aren't kicking down doors. It's a focused analysis of why the costing system at the inventory level is inappropriately estimating more usage of a raw material. And I know all of your listeners are now bored out of their mind. That's the accounting side of forensic accounting, right? That's still the nuts and bolts, debits and credits that we look at on a given day. The forensic side is really kind of accounting CSI, right? Everybody loved in the 90s and 2000s watching those crime shows. I'm sure they're still on. I don't know if we all have time to watch them anymore. Where the focus of the analysis and the consulting services may lead to decisions around investigation, around litigation, around law enforcement being involved. And a lot of our work can sometimes get there, right? So let's take that example of inventory costing. Hopefully everyone's awake again now that we've brought up crime. That inventory costing may account for an inappropriate system being installed, right? We thought our inventory costs were going to be 10x. They're actually 11x. That's why we're off. And the system that was installed is not right. And actually, our contract allows us to recover some loss from the business that installed that system. We need a report that says the system's wrong. So there we've got a forensic accountant showing that 11x is actually the right estimate number instead of 10x. And you're taking that to the business that installed it and said, hey, guys, I know we paid you $100. We probably only should have paid you $85. Can we split the difference? That business may agree and say, you're absolutely right. That's part of our contract. That business may disagree and say, no, you know, you paid what you paid. We're kind of done with you. And that organization with the inventory issue may decide to pursue legal action against that individual business, right? So that's where you start to get into that expert testimony in a litigation phase. And then to take it one example further, let's say we're looking at that disparity in projections for inventory cost, and it turns out the production manager is stealing inventory, right? Let's say you're creating laptop computers, and magically 10 computers disappear at the end of every month. That we're now getting into some of the more you know, popular topics on forensic accounting. How do we prove that John, the inventory manager, is stealing inventory? How do we align our analysis to be able to support the conclusions that'll lead to a criminal action or recovery from John? All of those types of things fit into that forensic accounting discussion. And part of your question was, you know, why we do it. For me, it's really, I really enjoy working with businesses, organizations, individuals who need help. And it's not because they are ill-equipped or disenfranchised. It's really a unique problem. And hey, Chris, hey, your team, you guys can come out and help us understand an issue that we've got, solve it, and maybe even be a better organization going forward because we've identified an issue and maybe closed out some of those, you know, lapses in the system that lets 10 laptops walk out the door or lets someone be able to sign checks to themselves, those kind of things. So not to be too kind of cheesy, but I really see a mission in the type of work that we provide as forensic accountants broadly to be able to answer those hard questions and support our clients and those organizations in a way that's meaningful to change their path on accounting issues and on, you know, potential loss or potential inefficiencies to be better going forward.
Yeah, and that's not cheesy at all because, I mean, really, that's what nonprofits are about. And that's what those of us who serve nonprofits are about, is finding that deeper mission and the reason for doing that. And so I feel like yours, it's pretty foundational to helping them stay afloat. I mean, nonprofits mm-hmm. tend to really need every dollar to serve their mission. And if some of it's leaking out the back door, that can be an issue. I mean, it's one thing if you're talking a small amount, which is still not good, but you get into hundreds of thousands and millions and, you know, some of the larger nonprofits, that's a noticeable leak.
Yeah, the one of the stats, I'm a member of the Association of Certified Fraud Examiners, which again, hopefully not everyone's bored when we go through those titles, but the ACFE every 2 years conducts a survey of its membership. There's over 400,000 members across the globe soliciting information about recent fraud cases. Many of them are nonprofits. Many of them are commercial businesses. They kind of run the gamut. And every 2 years, their study tries to align expectations around fraud risk. And the stat that comes out that they've normalized over, say, 20 years of conducting this study is that 5% of top-line revenue of your organization, of your business, of your concern is actually being lost to fraud on an annual basis. Again, this is an estimation. It's a painting with a broad brush. But the idea is that there are individuals or third parties that are interacting with an organization on a regular basis that are siphoning off 5%. So for all the nonprofiters out there thinking about the next grant application they're going to be filling out, thinking about their budget for next year, I mean, don't put a line in your budget for fraud loss, right? But think about what that 5% might mean for your mission, for your organization, to the people that are working hard to further the ideals of your NFP. What might we be able to do if we control that better and maybe take that 5% down to 2%, 1%, or hopefully right zero, although, you know, you can't really predict how those things go. So the work of forensic accountants in the nonprofit space, I think, is really, right, we'll use that word cheesy again, but it's really a great alignment between objectives and opportunity to serve. And the difference that a forensic accountant can make is astronomical. You quoted some numbers, right? $100,000. I know a vast majority of nonprofits that would bankrupt them, right? The services they provide to underprivileged kids in inner cities, or you know, unhoused individuals in rural communities, or folks needing you know, healthcare services or counseling services, right? That organization's gone, right? If you lose $60,000. Those services aren't being provided to that community. So we don't want to be scary here, but we just want to kind of be thinking about the right size of how organizations can consider a response to risks around fraud.
Right. And that's something I want to emphasize. This isn't a scare tactic. This isn't a let's create suspicion and go around, you know, evaluating your entire team and suspecting everyone. But I wanted to have this conversation to create awareness and diligence. Let's be good stewards. Let's pay attention to some of these things and at least understand that this can and does happen frequently. So how can we be proactive to prevent it? How can we set up safeguards, controls, checks and balances? So what would be some basic steps along those lines? It sounds like you've worked with small to large nonprofits and everything in between. So say for a nonprofit just starting to think about this, what are some good steps that they could take?
Well, Teresa, I'm glad you asked. And this will be, what, a 9-10 hour podcast, so I can cover all those. No, I'm kidding.
We're fine. We want people to have plenty to listen to.
That's right. Yeah, so it'll be a long listen. But I like to stick with the phrase that comes kind of from the political sphere, right? And a few decades ago, President Reagan, I believe, said, you know, trust but verify when it came to the nuclear disarmaments. That idea of trusting but verifying, I think in the commercial business world, is table stakes. You know, when you're working for a business and you submit an expense report, you attach a receipt because the business believes that you are incurring these expenses to further the aims of the business, but they want proof. And nobody is really offended by that. It's kind of just regular, right? You can think about if you report your sales numbers again for a commercial business, they want to see proof of that with contracts, right? Instead of saying, I made $100 million last year. Give me my bonus. It's okay, show me the customers, right? When we transition from that commercial posture into the nonprofit world, especially at organizations that are regional or local in nature, those conversations kind of change. When you start to ask folks about verifying the strategic decisions of a nonprofit, or why additional costs are incurred, or why they're chasing this new line of services that don't fit within the regular umbrella of where that organization might have been a year ago, there's just something about the mission-oriented ideas of a nonprofit that change the way individuals interact. And it's a shame. I wish, so you kind of said, what can we do to help? I'd say foster an environment where a questioning mindset is appropriate. I like to say, and this isn't the right phrase, but give me a business case, right? If we're going to go and spend this money, or we're going to go and take this strategic initiative, or we're going to try to serve a new community regionally or from a topical perspective, tell me why. Tell me why this works. Show me how it fits into our strategic plan. Show me how it comes under the mission, and show me how it's a cost benefit, if you will, not from a revenue and expenses side, but how does taking this $10,000 and going to this new community, you know, further our mission in a way that goes beyond, you know, just a $10,000 spend? Organizations that I've worked with in the past kind of fall within two camps, right? The first is, we hire the right people. We have a great team here. I don't need to question anybody on what they do. I trust them implicitly. And 9 times out of 10, Teresa, that's okay, right? You got 4 people sitting in an office, talking constantly, working on things all the time, supporting communities and missions out there that are meaningful. And they're connected, right? There's no friction there, no issue. The other kind of tail end of that discussion is the idea that we need to pursue every line item of every grant that we receive, of every funding source that we've got, to be in complete and total and utter compliance. And neither of those are wrong. There's benefits and costs to each of them, or friction to each of them. The compliance mindset really lends itself to understanding where there may be issues within an organization. The trust mindset, you know, you could maybe say is a little bit more focused on completing the mission than on checking every box. And so we try to bring those two ends of the spectrum closer together. So if you are totally compliance focused, when you walk into your organization's office in the beginning of the day and you have to sign a form that says, I swear that I'm starting work right now, that's probably a little bit too aggressive in terms of making a nonprofit work. And on the other side, if you never have to report to an office and you're working remotely and you kind of log in, you know, 2 or 3 times a month and nobody checks on you because everybody trusts each other, we probably want to add a little bit more compliance to that. So those are the ways we think about continuing to support the goals of a nonprofit, but also aligning objectives and activities to comply with funding sources, grants, you know, state and local regulations, you know, federal agencies. But taking a compliance mindset, right? If you walk into a staff meeting on a Monday morning and say, okay, everybody, we're doing fraud risk stuff now. I don't trust any of you. That's probably not going to be a great week, right, for your organization. But saying, hey, guys, you know, we just picked up another $100,000 from this state agency supporting our mission. And with that comes 5 or 6 things we need to do regularly for timekeeping, for service provision, for record keeping. We need to be in compliance with that. That discussion is a little bit easier. It's like, okay, yeah, we got a bunch more money, but we also need to do some things to keep in line. So changing that posture from super trust or super compliant and putting it together. really gets there. And like I said, I think that fostering that trust but verify idea can really help support the sometimes uncomfortable conversations that might happen. If that's already in the basis of the organization, there are oodles of cases that you can look at. Just Google nonprofit fraud, right? And you'll find the person that they've trusted for 25 years has been siphoning off, you know, $100,000 a year. Or, you know, the individual who's in charge of purchasing for this organization's brother is actually running a shell company that buys something at $10 and sells it to the nonprofit at $20, right? You'll find all those things out there. And I mean, I've been doing this for 15 years. There is nothing new under the sun, but there is always a nuance or a change to the way that things are being looked at that lend these things to happen. And the organizations that are most successful in identifying them before they become large or in stopping them before they start really have that foundational, let's all sit down and have a conversation about why we're spending this money or why we didn't hit our goals this year or why Steve is really floundering in his development position and how we can help him. Coming from a place of respect and trust, but asking to verify, I think, is a real, real quick way to hit on a lot of the things that we look for when we try to manage fraud risk.
That is so important. And I really think that balance, that mix is important to have some of both because, I mean, I'm in a lot of nonprofit forums and conversation groups where I have an ear to the ground on things. And there are so many toxic nonprofit cultures and mistrust out there that is really misplaced. And it's sad to watch and how much turnover there is. So I think too much control and suspicion in the wrong areas can really hurt the nonprofit culture. But on the other hand, like you said, too much freedom without any kind of accountability, any kind of systems and processes really opens the door to that temptation and that, oh, just a little, you know, a few dollars here won't matter. Nobody will notice this extra expense, things like that. So I do think there is that mix. I'm hearing more and more the term in this space, trust-based philanthropy. And so I think that is definitely trusting, but keeping those verification parameters in place. And something I work on a lot with nonprofits, I do a grant readiness audit to help them prepare, but that also includes looking at their systems. Do they have proper accountability in place, the proper ways of tracking a grant? Because if you just rush into a grant and then try to figure out, oh, we have to do financial reporting specifically on this money and how we used it. Oh, and they're caught off guard. So you really need to be proactive about some of that. I very much agree with having both ends of that and having a good, healthy mix.
I've been on the board of an organization in Washington, D.C. for about 6 years, serving as the treasurer in a variety of other positions. And what you talked about really rings to me. There's a program to provide victims of violent crime and sexual assault in the district with gift cards to grocery stores for food, for groceries, for supplies, for diapers, right? As families, you know, move around and try to find a safe space to be in, they may be displaced or have issues in sourcing some of those basic necessities. And the organization took on additional funding to help support this gift card program. But one of the things that they had to do was monitor the spend of every gift card that was handed out to every individual. And you can imagine, right, in a world of bad actors, right, you buy, you know, $100,000 worth of gift cards, you give them to all your friends, and everyone has groceries free for a year. That's not what the program was about. And it wasn't a distrust from the organization supplying the funds. It was a necessity to say, if we are ever questioned about how this program's running, can we say 99, 100% of all monies were spent at these stores and they were given to these 38 individuals and those 38 individuals qualify and they qualify for these reasons? I like to say that organizations that are really mission focused are also focused on that reputation. And I know that's a word that gets used all the time in nonprofits, focused on that reputation of compliance. I have never worked with an organization where the record keeping is great and people didn't understand why it had to be that way, right? No one's complaining about, I've got to track all these gift cards. They're like, we know. If we have one person take a gift card and, you know, buy alcohol and give it to a minor, right? Our reputation is ruined, right? For all, this entire program and even for the organization as a whole. So they knew from the start, from the get-go, that we need to have that system in place to be able to understand how we are complying, why we're complying, and whenever we're called to the carpet on it, we're able to answer that easy. That self-awareness can sometimes be hard in the nonprofit space too, because unlike a commercial business that's focused on profit or growth or expansion, the mission focus of a nonprofit really is obviously the soul and the passion of any organization, but it can also be a crutch when it comes to that paperwork, that compliance, that systems conversation. Well, I don't have time to deal with this. I need to go out and serve the population, the community that I'm looking to serve. I mean, it's a hard answer to argue with, right? So if you can get that mentality around the maturity of self-awareness to say, we need to have these things in place so we know when state agency, grantor, you know, donor comes in and asks a question, we can say, hey, we have a pretty good handle on this. We're not 100% sure, but here's everything we're looking at to make sure that happens.
Right. And I know that sometimes systems can seem cumbersome, intimidating, but truly a little bit of time up front on getting good systems in place, making sure everyone knows how to use the system, will pay off so many times over, not just with ease of use and workflow and having the compliance in place, but also from a grant making perspective, when you need data for a grant, whether it's an application or reporting, you've got it. It's in the system. Yep. So it really is a worthwhile way to spend your time and efforts up front. And then it puts it on the system. It's not personal. It's not any one staff member being called out. It's, hey, we have this system. Here's our process. Here's how we need you to follow the steps. This is just how we do things here. And it's about following the system and keeping things done well.
Yeah. And you use the word system, and I think you and I are talking about the same thing. Many of your listeners may think system means expensive, right? System means team of folks with computers and charts and meetings and all these software things that take my take my revenue to provide for, you know, the organizational mission down. And that is rarely the case, right? A system can be just a workflow of, okay, when we receive a check in our lockbox, what do we do with it? Having that written down on paper so that when someone new comes into the organization, they're able to respond to that quickly, that saves you a lot of time and energy to be able to make that happen. And if there's ever a problem or an issue to account for something, you've got those steps to follow. So when we say systems, I'd encourage the listeners out there to really think about not just, you know, paying a huge software company hundreds of thousands of dollars, but how do we formalize our process so we can get to that answer when we say, how many people did we help last year? You know, how many schools were built? How many wells were dug? How many? You're able to not only know that answer, but attribute activities, operational costs, efficiencies to each well, each school, each, you know, served individual to say, hey, we're doing good this year or not. And not to kind of have a spoiler alert here, but grantees or grantors and donors and foundations love that data. They love to be able to go back to their higher ups and say, we've identified an organization that is beating their, you know, industry in the philanthropy world because they're digging wells, you know, cheaper and more effectively. And here's how they know that. That is the easiest sell, right? And not that this is a selling environment, but the easiest conversation to have to say, you guys gave us 100 last year, give us 150 and let's see what we can do with it this year. Going back to the board of a foundation and having those conversations is really, really easy. So I know we're throwing a lot at you, right? Fraud risk, systems, analytics, data and all that. But I like to think too, I got some advice early in my career from a leading accountant with the AICPA who described thinking about your career in terms of, he was a big downhill skier. And so he said, I like to think about my career the same way I think about downhill skiing. And that first off, you have to look right in front of you to make sure you're not going to hit a rock or bounce off a mogul or fall down. Then you got to look about 50 to 150 yards in front of you to say, am I going towards a thicket of bushes? Am I going to hit a bunch of trees? And then finally, you got to look all the way down the mountain to say, am I going back to the lodge where my car is, right? How am I going to get home? And he equated that to thinking about your career, very focused detail in the short term, more general and broad focus in the medium term. And then finally, what's the end state? What's the end goal of that? So in a 1 year, 5 year, 10 year period. So when I talk to nonprofits about their posture around systems and compliance, it's not binary. It's not, we're not doing this today, let's do this tomorrow. It's a spectrum of maturity. What can we do in the next fiscal year, the next reporting cycle to get better? What does that look like if we do it for 5 years? And then hopefully what's our end state kind of at the horizon? Maybe a goal we'll never meet, but that we can aim for to say, yes, I want to be an organization that can tell every donor dollar for dollar how much we're spending on administrative costs, how much we're giving to the focus of our mission, and then what we have as a benefit that's maybe helping the community outside of that.
You just called out so many good things that I'm glad you brought up. And starting with the most recent, I like to really challenge nonprofits to make sure they have a clear vision and their mission and their core values, because that sets the direction and becomes a filter for everything they do. If you don't know which side of the mountain your lodge is on and you start down the wrong side of the mountain, you may be not hitting the rocks and bumps, but you're going to end up completely at the wrong lodge or all by yourself somewhere stranded. So understanding what is the end goal, what's that big vision, and then you can work backwards to figure out your path towards it. Even if you don't have all the clear exact steps along the way, but just making sure you have that everyone on the same page. And then I'm also really glad you pointed that out about systems don't have to be expensive. It can be a spreadsheet. It can be an intake form for the clients coming in of just some quick questions to make sure you know, who are we serving? How are we tracking this? Where are they from? You know, different types of data that you need. And that becomes very useful, like you said, with foundations or donors, because there may be others out there doing similar work that are not tracking as well. So if you're tracking and you can show that proof and the track record and the work that you're doing and how effective it's been, you're going to seem like a more solid candidate and be more competitive.
Yeah. And just 2 points on that quickly, the kind of the systems idea, right? Many nonprofits out there maybe, okay, where do I start? What I like to say is, let's look at the last year and think about what we wish we knew, right? Either during the year or at the end. You know, how do we look at the services we're providing, or, you know, the research we're funding, and evaluate if it was good or not? And that can be a tough conversation. You know, I don't think anyone's going to come usually, you know, I work in the world of fraud, so I'm a little bit more jaded than the average bear. Usually folks are coming to an organization to help further that mission, right? So how do we evaluate the 11, you know, research projects that were funded by your nonprofit last year? Which ones did exceedingly well? Which ones met expectations, and which ones fell by the wayside? And then how do we control for that in the next year, right? How will we know if the 11 we choose this year are better, worse, or the same? Not worse in terms of outcomes, but worse in terms of maybe efficiencies along that way. And then secondarily to that, I think the organizational focus of donor dollars or grant funding can sometimes create a competitive attitude in the nonprofit space. And I would tell everybody to turn that dial down. Of course, there are limited funding sources and limited donor dollars out there. But if you can learn from another organization in your space about how they're effective, or you can share that with another organization, I'm a firm believer that a high tide raises all boats. And when it comes down to the mission-focused orientation of nonprofits, I would encourage everyone to really lean into that and work with other nonprofits in your community, even if you're kind of on the same grant applications, right? Or some of those things. Because I think that if we could all learn from each other in a way that's helpful, then even if that organization got 100 this year and you only got 50, all 150 that's going to be spent better in furtherance of the mission, right? And then maybe next year you're the one that gets 100 and they get 50, and you can kind of talk about the differences and really work together in that. So it can be hard when you're looking at your budget for the next year and saying, oh, I know this other organization's out there in a similar lane to us. They're the favorites of this specific foundation. I don't know if we're going to get that. I'd encourage you to reach out to them, right? And have an honest conversation about how can we be more like you guys that always, you know, win this? Or how do we kind of replicate what we do in a way that's more meaningful along the way? Which is definitely different than kind of the commercial business side that we have here in the U.S., where things can be a little bit more competitive and almost to a detriment. In the nonprofit space, I don't believe it's a zero-sum game. I think there are limitations to funding, but I think that if folks can align themselves to be efficient and effective in their mission, then everybody wins, even if the dollars change hands over time.
I feel like you have been like a fly on the wall for some of my emails with clients, because I have so often said I'm a huge fan of collaboration where it makes sense. Mm-hmm. Like if there's another agency either doing similar work or complementary work, or ahead of you or a little behind you, I am a huge fan. Like, let's pool our resources together and support each other to make the sector stronger. If we're truly about impacting these missions, let's not stay isolated and protective and secretive. Let's help each other, because that's what it's going to take to really impact the sector as a whole, is more of that collaboration. So I'm a huge fan of that.
Yeah. And I like to think of it too as a evaluation of growth, right? I think I'll make a broad assumption here. Every nonprofit wants to do more, be larger, more revenue, more services provided, more research funded in the years to come. But I challenge organizations, and I'm a child of the 80s and 90s, big into video games, right? Mario was probably my first best friend. How do we level up the organization, right? I know you want it. You have 100 in revenue this year. You want to have 105 next year. But how do we level up the services that we provide? I'll go back to the board that I was on. I don't know if Bridget, you're out there listening to this, the executive director, but she really schooled me on a lot of things about the way nonprofits think about themselves from a maturity spectrum. And they use this example, at least in the framework that she was utilizing, about being at the bottom of a river and having a bunch of folks come down the river and being injured and providing services to those folks, you know, as they came down the river. Maybe there was a battle up this river or a disaster or something like that. And organizations can get caught in the cycle of just serving the folks who are coming down the river and need help. And her framework was challenging, why don't we go up the river and see what's wrong? And maybe it's an earthquake, right? We can't deal with an earthquake. It's going to happen and people are going to be injured and we can help them. But maybe it's, you know, something else, you know, a sickness, right? Or something up the river. And again, this is just kind of a hypothetical example, but how do we move up the river and help solve the problem that's creating the need for these services? That to me is a great example of leveling up. It is impossibly hard, right? It is not something you can wake up on a Monday and solve by Friday for a lot of the reasons that all of you are out there serving the communities you are. But if you keep that kind of horizon vision down the road of, in a perfect world, if we could make sure everyone who's unhoused in our city has housing, that, I mean, that's a very lofty and worthwhile goal. It's probably really difficult to accomplish that. But if you look continually up the river for how do we solve the needs that these people have before they get to us, that's kind of a way to think about how could we level up our organization and not just get more money, provide more services, but how do we really impact the community in a way that can help drive our mission forward? And I'll say maybe even solve some of the issues that you're seeing in the organizations that are providing these services.
Love that. And again, I feel like you've been listening in, because I often say we need to move upstream a bit instead of just saying, how can grants fix our problem? I'm saying, how can we move upstream a few steps to have better systems, better foundations, better data, better all the parts and pieces so that we can present better grant applications down the road. And so, yeah, exact same concept. And I also want to encourage nonprofits that are listening that no matter where you are, as far as developing and collecting and tracking some of this, you're already started and going. So you're not starting from scratch. And there's always room to continue improving, continue leveling up. So it's not like a destination that, oh, we have to arrive at this point.
Exactly.
It's more of a journey of ongoing, because the climate changes, the situation, the community, the needs, everything is always shifting. Even just the, I'm sure the laws and legalities sometimes of what they need to track. And so making sure that our systems are always optimized for where we are right now and where we want to go, and continuously working to make sure they are what we need for right now. And I, again, you know, I really like what you said earlier about just making the conversation normal, not threatening, not suspicious and attacking, but just a normal part of, this is how we do business. Tell me why this is important. It's not an argumentative case. Yeah. It's just a, we need to logic through. Sometimes the answer might be yes. Sometimes it might be no. We have to be okay with that. And just making that a normal conversation.
It's hard to change culture. If like you talked about some of the toxic nonprofit culture, I'm sure you and I have both seen, but coming from a place of sincerity and humility in order to make that change happen, it's going to take time. But if you can say today, you know, is the end of the year here in 2023, if by 2024 we can have a system where we can talk to each other regularly, whether that's an anonymous hotline where folks can write in, you know, internally or externally about how the organization's doing. Or maybe we have quarterly meetings where an executive director or a board is meeting individually with folks who may have concerns about the organization, about the way things are run. Each of those is just a real small step that helps support that culture. And the best thing to do is talk about it at the end. So let's say you got a year to figure out how to improve your culture. Go back to your people, your funding sources, your donors, your employees, the administrators who are helping you, and say, hey, guys, we implemented the system to let people say whatever the heck they wanted. Here's what they said, and here's how we responded to it. That is just such an empowering place to be in. A gentleman, Tom Hood, who's a leader with the AICPA, always says one of the most powerful phrases in leadership is, what do you think? Right, being able to ask the folks that work with you, for you, and collaborate with you, what do you think, is so meaningful to help engender folks to improving an organization.
True, and if not fixed, they could snowball into big problems. I think the second step to that, I love that question, what do you think? Then to stop and listen, to truly listen, and yes, create an atmosphere, an environment for listening, not just a passive, what do you think? Oh, nah, let's not.
Yeah, thanks.
I mean, are they gonna speak up next time if they think you're gonna always shoot it down? And that doesn't mean always saying, oh yes, we'll do that. If it's not like, no, we can't bring in ice cream all day, every day, or, you know, like some things just are not, that would be great in theory, but not healthy and productive.
That's right.
But I mean, I wouldn't mind. But then just stopping to listen and collect and take that time to reflect, like, okay, we have a pool of great ideas here. Which ones align most with helping us get towards our mission and vision? Which ones do we want to set aside for now? Which ones do we want to use, tweak, continue refining? So I love that process of listening. This has been full of so many good practical tips. I hope nonprofits are taking notes, and I feel like they will be, because these are just so good. If this is a new concept to a nonprofit, where would you recommend they start with having these conversations or going through and just starting to really evaluate what would be a good first step?
I think, you know, I might be biased here, but I think every nonprofit should be involved in some manner with a financial professional on their board or as a part of their administration, right? We talked about compliance and fraud risk up front. That's obviously the world I play in beyond a lot of the nonprofit things we talked about. But I think having someone coming into an organization who believes in the mission but is not biased so much to the mission that they're forgetting their, you know, background as an attorney or an accountant or a financial advisor, that is a conversation changer, right? I think, you know, in the board meetings I've been a part of, whether I'm on the board or advising them, when the accountant stands up and talks, you know, people either go to sleep because they don't want to look at a spreadsheet, or they trust that person to, you know, safeguard the assets of the organization, right? I think having specialists in that area is an important spot. And we talked a little bit, some nonprofits out there are heavily regulated or in industries that require some legal advice. Definitely be involved with those folks. And I would work with organizations to say, blame me, right? I'm the outsider. So if you think there needs to be a change in here that relates to what I'm saying, use me as the crutch, right? You don't have to be the bad guy. Make Chris the bad guy. I can take it, and, you know, I'm consulting with you, and I'm going to be gone in 6 months, and you're going to be on your way. So that makes it a little easier. So I would seek out that financial or legal advice as an external party. Most law firms and accounting firms and businesses in your area with that expertise will take pro bono activities to help support the community, right? Not only from their own reputational aspect, but it's good for their people to get involved with those organizations. And then kind of second to that is, we talked a lot about self-awareness. It is so, so hard as an organization to admit your weaknesses and in some cases admit your strengths, right? We're all taught at an early age to be humble and kind and not be, you know, brag about ourselves or, you know, hold ourselves out there. But some of those organizations out there, you know, for the leadership that might be listening to this podcast or even the staff who are supporting it, it can feel like you're on pins and needles every day, right? We got to get this grant or else we're in trouble. But think about all the good that you are doing, right? With the money you've got, with the people that are working on these services with you, and really take stock of what you're good at and where you need help, and then seek out that help. I don't want everyone to walk away going, oh my God, everyone's stealing from me all the time. We're never going to make it out of this hole. Because a lot of organizations just need to have that honest internal conversation about where we're aligned with our mission, not only the mission of the services or the support that we're providing to the community, but our mission as an organization to grow, to benefit our people, to support the community. Knowing where you have those strengths and able to improve those weaknesses leads to a lot of the conversations that'll help support maturity in systems, in funding sources, in, you know, the use of administrative dollars versus services dollars. All those things kind of fall down the road. Fall like dominoes after you get aligned with what you're good at.
Mm-hmm. So good. And I agree. Sometimes nonprofits just need that initial step. And one thing I do in my grant readiness audit is help them see the gold mine of resources they're sitting on that they're probably not even tapping into. Of, hey, you guys, you have these connections, these resources, these skill sets that you're not using. And so being able to do that. And then I think just like you said, making those processes normal and part of every day, because there's probably nonprofits out there that maybe fraud, like full-blown fraud, is not necessarily happening, but their systems are messy and fuzzy and cloudy, and nobody really quite knows what expenses are okay and which ones aren't, or which ones can be attributed to this grant and which ones can't. Like, they may just have never been defined for people, and so we can't expect people to hold to standards that haven't ever been set and clarified. So sometimes it's just cleaning up. And so I think, I mean, you sound like, as parents, that's what we had told our kids, and my parents had told me, like, if you need to blame somebody to get out of a situation, you can always blame us. And I appreciated that from my parents. And so we've done that with our kids. I don't know if they ever used it, but they knew they could. we'll be the bad guys. So yeah, it's the same way. And then that helps make it less emotional and personal.
Yep.
It makes it more of just again, back to the system for the things that can go to systems, and then always putting the people first. And
that's right.
How can we relate to people and take care of people, whether it's our internal team or the people we're serving in the community? So, yeah, I think that is fantastic advice, very practical, that I hope nonprofits will start to have some conversations with their team, with their leadership and the board, and really think about how they can integrate some of these practices.
Definitely.
Well, as we wrap up, would you share, if you have something, a specific resource that has been especially useful to you in your journey?
It's a broad question, right? From a professional side, right? I talked a little bit about the Association of Certified Fraud Examiners, the ACFE, earlier, the largest provider of anti-fraud education and support across the globe. They have a lot of connections to services for risk management for fraud professionals in your area, specific to nonprofits, that are free. So go on and check out acfe.org. Great organization. If you're interested in some of the things you can do in the short term to help manage fraud risk, or, you know, read some of the stories out there of where things may have gone wrong and how your organization can avoid those. Resources from a personal side, and this might be a little bit off topic to the average nonprofit, but as an individual, I like to think like a nonprofit, and having a personal board of directors, right, to talk through issues and understand not only individually how I'm doing, where I'm going professionally, personally, and otherwise, but being able to work with people who care about you, whether they're in the office next to you or somebody that you know from high school or all those kind of things. We've talked a lot on this episode about accountability and maturity, humility and self-awareness. It is so hard to do that for an organization and for an individual. So asking somebody that cares about you, I think, is a very important resource as well. So I'd encourage everybody out there listening, from a professional or personal perspective, think about who you really trust and knows you, that you can bounce ideas off of, or think about where you're going next. And that's going to be different for everybody. But that's a resource I've gone back to the well, you know, numerous times, especially when it's tough, numerous times a week to say, how can I be better? Where can I go to get there?
Yeah. And that's sometimes painful, but that's how we grow. We need those people to speak into us. And we know they love us. We know it's for our good. Yes. And so that's where it's like, oh, you're right. So yeah, I think that's a great
thing. I hate hearing this from someone who knows me so well, because they're definitely accurate.
And I hate that they're right, but I know I have to do it. Yeah. Sometimes that's what we need, though, to just push us off center when we get stuck and keep us going again. Yeah, very good.
Excellent.
So, well, thank you. And please tell us, where can people find you online to learn more or to connect with you if they have follow-up questions or other resources that you have to share?
Yeah, so I'd encourage anybody to reach out to me on LinkedIn, right? As an accountant, that's where all of us go to talk about professional issues and share some of our ideas. So you can find me at linkedin.com/in/EkimoffCPA. That's my last name, Ekimoff, and then the letter CPA for that profession. I'm also pretty active on formerly Twitter, now X, in talking about some of these professional issues. And for those of you who are interested in more podcast time, not that this won't have already given you every answer you need, a colleague of an attorney friend of mine and I run a podcast with the Practicing Law Institute, a legal education service where we talk about fraud issues, securities law, some interesting things in the stock market. So definitely check out the Insecurities Podcast from PLI wherever you listen, and then feel free to reach out to me on LinkedIn for more information about nonprofit work, fraud risk, and how we might be able to help or just have a good conversation.
Very good. All right. I will link to all those things in the show notes so people can click through if they have questions. And so,
Excellent.
very good. Well, thank you so much. This has been fantastic. So much good information. And I'll definitely compile this into notes as well on the blog. And so,
Appreciate
yep,
it.
I hope people will use this as a resource and share it with their team so they can have some good, productive conversations to get them moving forward.
You got it. Thanks for the opportunity, Teresa.
All right, what do you think of this one? I would love to hear your biggest takeaways, your questions. No doubt you probably have some follow-up things that you're wondering. So I'd love to hear what those are and how you're going to implement Chris's tips in your operations and in your systems. Now, remember, like we had said several times, this is not a scare tactic. This is not to put fear into you so you don't sleep at night anymore. Nothing like that. This is more to help you be proactive, to get ahead of things, to make sure you understand your numbers, you understand what to look for, and you know how to set up good processes to make sure things are running smoothly. I talk a lot about building your ROI from my TEDx talk, and you can reference past episodes, but really making sure that you have the O piece, that you are optimized, and that your operations are locked in and running smoothly. We want you successful. We don't want you hitting a glitch that can be expensive or even worse and get you in all kinds of trouble. So by listening to resources like this and following up and making sure that you have those in place, this can really be a proactive way to keep things running smoothly. All right, friends. Again, I'd always love to hear from you. So please let me know, connect on LinkedIn, reach out on my website. There's a contact form there. Or you can leave me a voicemail on my website and I will get back to you. All right, so keep up the good work. The world needs you out there supporting nonprofits. And if you're not quite sure how to do that, ask me. I want to help you do this because your community needs you and they need the skills that you have. Don't hold back out of fear. You can do this. All right, friends, have a great week and go change your world.